V for Vendetta, novelization by Steve Moore, continued. Disc 2. Over at New Scotland Yard, Chief Inspector Finch was starting to feel as rumpled as his old suit. He'd been out of bed as soon as the music started and the sirens went off. A couple of hours at the Old Bailey, a couple of hours at his desk, then that bloody cabinet meeting, then back to his desk again. And the desk was no more of a pretty sight than he was. A litter of reports, a mess of notes, a keyboard and a monitor, a couple of phones, and he'd piled up more empty coffee cups there than he had leads right now. And still the reports came in. 95% useless, but needing to be checked anyway. And if he wasn't careful, they'd topple over again, and then he wouldn't know where he was or what he'd already read. If it had just been something simple and comprehensible, like a bank raid. But no, it had to be a terrorist attack, with incomprehensible trimmings like fireworks and bloody concertos. A cooperative operation between the nose and the finger, this was supposed to be, whether he wanted it or not, and duplicate reports to be faxed as fast as WPC Barnden could send them. Poor girl had been sending out stuff all morning. Not that he was getting much from Creedy and his finger men, but that was typical. Take everything, give nothing back. Bloody Creedy. Well, two could play at that game. Maybe he'd tell Lizzie Barnden to go sick tomorrow, and then be too short-staffed to find anyone to replace her for a while.
"I don't get it,"
remarked Detective Sergeant Dominic Stone, Finch's lieutenant. DSDS, as he was usually known to the Yard's canteen staff, whom he somehow charmed into giving him all the prime cuts and extra helpings. The younger man looked up in puzzlement from a desk that was far, far more organized than his boss's. Almost clean, Finch thought disgustedly, but he'd grow out of that. At least he hoped he would. Not like the last DS he'd had, who'd had half his head blown off in that Scottish Nationalist Army terror attack a couple of years ago. Finch liked Dominic Stone for his personality as well as his efficiency, and always thought of him as Dominic, rather than Sergeant Stone. Probably liked him a bit too much. After all, if Finch's son, Peter, hadn't died along with his mother back in the Troubles at the time of the Reclamation, he'd be... Well, thinking about that didn't help him get on with the job.
"Why does he wear a Guy Fawkes mask and then blow up the Old Bailey?" Dominic continued. "Didn't Fawkes try to blow up Parliament?"
"It's not too late," Finch told him wearily. "Maybe he's just getting started." He almost added, "But let's not go there." But before the words could reach his lips, the phone rang on Dominic's desk. Finch looked up at him as he took the call. Young, handsome, well-groomed, smart and eager. He'd grow out of all of those things if he stayed in this business long enough. The hair would be the first to go, falling out with worry while trying to solve just this sort of case. For a moment, Finch wondered if he was looking at himself when he was young, but then decided it was just stupid, wasting time thinking about things like that. Instead, he turned his attention back to the photo of the terrorist that one of the CCTV cameras had picked up the previous night, and who, or what, was he looking at here? The mask, the grin, the whole bloody pantomime outfit. A joke? Or a nightmare? The train of thought was suddenly interrupted as Dominic slammed down the phone and leapt to his feet excitedly.
"A lead on the girl!"
And so, with a gravity that his age and position had earned him, and the weariness that being up all night brought as well, Finch dropped the photo back on the desk and heaved himself out of the chair. Maybe there was something here for an old dog to get his teeth into after all. The girl in question was, just then, about to encounter another older man, the one she was supposed to have met the previous night. Gordon Dietrich was a long-time producer and variety show frontman from the old multi-channel days, back before everything had gone to hell and there was nothing left afterward but the British television network, whether anyone liked it or not. He'd spent a while in the wilderness while the new powers that be were getting themselves set up, which he'd at first put down to the idea that the programmes he used to make were far too coarse for present tastes. And then, suddenly, he'd got the call to produce a new, weekly, government-approved variety show. Only when he read the brief did he realise that he'd actually got the job, because now they couldn't possibly find anyone coarser. Even so, there were limits. But as long as he provided enough cheap laughs and syrupy pap to keep the mindless masses entertained, well, it was a living. Frankly, it was a damned good living. And living was what a lot of the media people he used to know just weren't doing any more. The ones who used to flounce into the office every morning and call everybody darling and sweetie. Not since the reclamation.
"Look, don't get me wrong," Beatrick was saying as Evie approached his open door, tea tray in hand.
She had to smile at that. Like every other producer in the building, he was always on the phone.
"I love it," he continued. "A cow getting crucified. It's hysterical, but we'll never get it approved."
He looked up then, a slightly wolfish glint in his eyes. He saw Evie enter the room.
"You've got to rewrite it, okay?" he told the hapless script man at the other end of the line. And before there was time for further argument, "Gotta go!"
Hanging up as Evie put the tea tray down on his desk, he got to his feet and walked round to join her. A big-boned and large-featured man who was probably in his 50s, Evie thought, and with what he preferred to think of as a fairly well-rounded figure, not quite fat, but he obviously lived well, he was well known to have an eye for the younger and more attractive office staff. There were two ways to regard a man with a reputation like that, and Evie preferred to look upon him as a source of potential opportunities.
"I can't recall ever being stood up by a more attractive woman," he said, though the smile playing round his lips was intended to lessen the accusation just a little.
"Mr. Dietrich," Evie began, blushing with embarrassment, but he cut her off.
"Gordon, please. I don't need Mr. to make this body feel any older."
That, of course, just made her feel even more embarrassed. But she knew that something had to be said before the peach flush on her cheeks turned into something more like beetroot.
"Gordon, I was on my way last night, but there were fingermen about, and I got a little scared and went home."
Dietrich paused then, looking thoughtful for a moment.
"Sadly, I think after last night our curfew will only get worse."
A sigh before he added, "But you're probably right. In days like these, home is probably the safest place to be." Not for Evie Hammond, though. Not any more. The once safe haven of her apartment was breached forever, as Finch and Dominic kicked in the door, bursting in with guns drawn. A few moments' tension as they checked the shabby rooms, that swiftly drained away as they realized no one else was there. Pistols put away. That always made Finch feel better, remembering how, when he'd joined the force, only special units had carried guns. They began to look around, checking drawers and closets for anything that might help. Letters, an address book, an answer phone, anything. Not that there was much here that suggested this was the home of a dangerous terrorist. Certainly no bomb-making equipment, no lists of targets or plans of action. The place looked as if it could have belonged to any young woman of relatively little means, student, office worker, shop girl. The clothes were cheap. The decor was worse. It was Finch who noticed the mirror, with the photos tucked in all around the frame. And there amongst the others, of course, was one of Evie herself, a perfect match for the rather more blurry image picked up on the CCTV cameras. A glance toward Dominic, and then, "Gotcha," he said to the photo. And meant it, too. This was just the confirmation of identity they needed. 4. The more she thought about it as the morning progressed, the more Evie wished she'd managed to make it to Gordon Dietrich's the previous night, nocturnal adventures notwithstanding. Though it had to be said, the more she thought about those nocturnal adventures, the more hair-raising they became. After all, the grand-sounding junior personal assistant was just a joke, really. They might just as well call her Gopher Number 2. Fetch the coffee, go and find this, send out for that. Now it was collect the latest delivery from the main entrance. If she could actually work up to really being someone's personal assistant instead of anyone's assistant, she might actually stop being run off her feet all the time. One day, she thought. Well, maybe one day she'd go a lot further than that. After all, she'd always wanted to be in front of the cameras, not behind them. But with her background, she'd never had the opportunities for that sort of thing. If she could just get herself noticed by someone, someone who might be interested in her. Right now, though, she was all alone in the elevator, with a hand cart stacked with perfectly uniform Fedco boxes, every one alike, with their green and black stripe emblazoned on the side. Typical government mail system. Everything the same. Regular size, regular weight, regular colour. Typical of the entire government itself, in fact. It was just a surprise that everyone didn't have to wear the same regular uniforms the way they used to do in China back in the days of Chairman Mao. Best not to think about that sort of thing, though. Every time she thought of a way that things could get worse, they usually did. As it was, the only uniformed people around Jordan Tower were the security guards, and there was one before her as the elevator doors opened and she pushed out the handcart. Fortunately, this was one of the friendlier ones, unlike the shoot-to-kill goons they had on the main door. A time server, just putting in his hours and taking home his paycheck, and far more interested in watching the latest episode of Storm Saxon than his security monitors. "Hey, Fred," called Evie cheerily, dragging his attention away momentarily from the brill-creamed Aryan hero of England's future nightmare, when the degenerates and terrorists were back and they had to be severely dealt with, just as they'd been before, only this time using laser lugers and rocket racers.
"All that stuff been X-rayed?"
the big security man asked casually, his eye wandering briefly from the screen to run over the boxes, lingering a little longer on Evie and then going back to where it had started.
"Nope," joked Evie, knowing full well she'd passed them through the machine herself. "They're filled with bombs."
"Well, wait till the commercial to set them off, okay?"
Fred Thorpe said complacently, a faint grin on his round face as he held out a docket for her to sign.
"I can't believe you watched that shit," said Evie, scribbling her name.
"What?"
he exclaimed, finally reacting in just the same startled way she expected he would. Almost as if she'd suggested that football had no importance in the greater scheme of things, or pin-up girls.
"But Laser Lassie's just banging!"
Stifling a giggle and deciding this must be some masculine epithet she hadn't come across before, Evie gave the handcart a shove and went on her way. After all, banging wasn't anything that was shown on TV these days, even if some of Gordon Dietrich's shows did get pretty near the knuckle sometimes. A couple of minutes later she'd arrived at her destination, the wardrobe department. The racket that hit her as soon as she opened the door was almost overwhelming after the quiet of the corridor. But when 20 nubile young women were hurriedly dressing up in showgirl costumes, it really wasn't surprising. And somewhere in that noisy mass of blonde wigs, corsets, fishnet stockings, high heels, ostrich feathers and sequins, Evie finally managed to find the wardrobe mistress, a woman far less interested in her own appearance than that of the girls she was trying to dress. In fact, her own appearance had gone to hell long ago, but when she'd gone through 3 husbands and had 5 kids, that sort of thing didn't seem to matter much anymore.
"What's all that?"
she asked bad-temperedly, eyeing the stack of boxes suspiciously and thrusting a handful of safety pins into her pocket.
"Not sure,"
Evie told her, not really caring. As far as she was concerned, this was just one more job to get out of the way before she went to lunch.
"They just arrived. Marked for stage 3.
A sour expression crossed the older woman's face, which quite plainly said, "As if I don't have enough problems already without this." And after that she jumped to a conclusion that didn't improve her temper one iota.
"Must be Prothero," she snapped. "I wish someone had the balls to tell him this station isn't his own personal bloody playground."
With that, she grabbed one of the boxes from the stack and ripped it open.
"What the hell is this?"
she asked, pulling out a long black cape and a mask. A mask that Evie instantly recognized. A Guy Fawkes mask. V's mask. Evie could hardly breathe. She felt the blood draining from her face, feared the shock would give her away immediately, started to panic, a return of the same sort of overpowering fear that had dominated her whole life since she was a little girl, that only ever left her when she was too busy to think. But if the wardrobe mistress saw anything in Evie's expression at all, she seemed to take it only as incomprehension. Stuffing the mask and cape back roughly into the box and tossing it back on the pile, she turned away disgustedly and said,
"Just put them over there until I can figure out what they're for."
And then she was off among her charges once again, straightening feathers and fixing diamante brooches, snapping and yelling in the babble of voices that filled the room. And not noticing at all how Evie had left without uttering a word. Without being able to utter a word. A minute later she was back in the JPA's room, burdened with a secret she wished she didn't have, and almost choking on a rising sense of desperation.
"What is it?"
Vicky asked with genuine concern, immediately realizing something was wrong.
"What happened?"
"I don't feel very well,"
stammered Evie, white-faced and looking every bit as sick as she said she was.
"I think I have to go."
Hoping desperately that Vicky wouldn't ask her anything else, Evie began grabbing her things and stuffing them into her bag. It was a forlorn hope, of course.
"Was it Dietrich?"
probed Vicky.
"What did that old pervert say?"
"No, it was nothing like that,"
Evie said hurriedly, wanting to tell Vicky to mind her own business, but knowing that would only make things worse.
"I just have to go."
And she did. Sitting in the car, while Dominic sent it hurtling from Paddington toward the Jordan Tower, Finch had got Eva's record up on the dashboard computer system, and was intent on having something to concentrate on instead of the young man's hair-raisingly dangerous driving. Whether it was lunacy, or confidence, or just that boy's toy feeling of having a police car to drive around in, regardless of the limit, Finch never really knew. He just had a nasty feeling that if ever he came to a sudden end, it wouldn't be a terrorist bullet that did it, it would be Dominic's driving. Still, in this case there did seem to be a compelling reason for it. "This looks serious," Finch remarked, not wanting to glance up at the street hurtling far too swiftly past the window, at the trucks Dominic insisted on weaving around, at the pedestrians who stood gawping in disbelief. "Her parents were political activists. They were detained when she was 12.
"What happened to her?"
Dominic asked, turning his head in a way Finch didn't like at all. "Juvenile reclamation project for 5 years.
"Shit,"
said Dominic, having read far too many criminal records that started off in the brutal hell of a JRP and just went downhill from there. Usually until they suddenly stopped. Dead.
"We're going to need backup. But let's keep it minimal. I want to stay under Creedy's radar."
"You sure about that, sir?" Dominic asked in surprise. And now his eyes were definitely not on the road.
"I just want a chance to talk to her before she disappears into one of Creedy's black bags. And for Christ's sake, look where you're going!"
Back at the security station in Jordan Tower, that Evie had passed by only a few minutes before, Fred Thorpe was still devotedly watching Storm Saxon and licking his lips in anticipation. After all, Laser Lass was a big girl, and one day she was bound to have an accident and fall out of that skimpy costume, and he wanted to make sure he was watching when it happened. If only he were Rex Rannell, the lucky bastard who played Storm Saxon. So he wasn't looking round at the security monitors when the first of them fritzed out into static. Or the second. In fact, by the time he noticed anything at all, Laser Lass having temporarily disappeared from the scene, more than half the screens were dead, including just about all the ones covering the immediate area around his security station.
"What the hell?"
he gasped, swinging round in his seat and starting to get to his feet. The last thing he needed right now was to have to go and find an electrician, right in the middle of Storm Saxon. Or, worse still, start some sort of full-scale security alert just because of a blown fuse somewhere. The soft ding of an arriving elevator cut across his thoughts, and by the time the doors slid open, he hardly had a moment left to think at all.
"Who's that?"
he shouted, seeing only a grinning white mask, a wide-brimmed hat, and a floor-length cloak wrapped round a form that moved with supple swiftness. It could be an actor in costume, of course, that was the obvious conclusion. But somehow he didn't think it was. And besides, since last night's bombing, everyone around here had been nervous as hell, even without the loudspeakers urging vigilance and announcing new security measures. Vigilance, he had to admit, that he hadn't actually been too hot on the last half hour. And somehow the guilt over that, or was it fear his lapses would be discovered, meant that he was suddenly completely on the ball, and angry about it too.
"I ain't playing,"
the security guard yelled next, reaching for his gun. A gun he'd never had to use and had always hoped he never would.
"You show me ID or you get the bloody Storm Saxon treatment. Right now!"
The dark figure before him said nothing. And that in itself was far more frightening than if he had. Instead, he merely opened the cloak to show the little party trick he'd brought along to provide some entertainment. A heavy vest of dynamite sticks strapped all around his chest, the detonator nestling in his black-gloved hand.
"Fucking hell," was all that Thorpe could say to that.
And the masked but smiling figure nodded, as if to say, "Yes, indeed, it was." From outside, the sound of approaching police sirens could be heard, but V seemed quite unmoved, almost as if he didn't believe they could be coming here. With swift and silent efficiency, he disarmed the security guard, then delivered precise but whispered instructions, and they made their way off down the corridor, the one as cool as ice, the other chilled with fear. A moment or two later, Evie passed the security station on her way to the same elevator, and paused at what she saw. Or rather, what she didn't. This wasn't right at all. Fred was never missing from his post, especially not during Storm Saxon. The corridor was never this eerily silent. A dread anticipation made her gut clench. She had to get out of here. And she had to get out now. Not far away, the door to the main news studio suddenly swung open, and everyone within froze to statue stillness. The only emotion was from the two figures that entered, the one familiar, the other quite the contrary. His cloak swishing the ground, the detonator in his hand, the dynamite in view, V floated in with a serene silence, accompanied by the plainly terrified Fred Thorpe, who pushed along the handcart filled with Fedco boxes that Evie had earlier delivered. And at the instant that Evie was about to press the elevator button, V stepped across to the studio wall and hit the fire alarm. Down in the lobby, Finch, Dominic, and their assembled backup of armed and uniformed officers suddenly reeled as the air filled with thunderously loud alarm bells, and all the building's elevators promptly shut down. And to a man, the company of police pulled out their guns. "You two cover the elevators," Finch ordered, heading for the stairwell. "The rest of you, follow me." Many floors above, while the studio staff cowered in terror, V used an electric drill to drive a heavy bolt through the metal entry door and into the jamb, sealing it shut. And no one made a move to stop him. Evie, meanwhile, frustrated by the elevator's sudden seizure, found herself surrounded by a crowd of the tower's employees heading urgently toward the stairwell. Having no alternative, she let herself be swept along with them. And maybe it was for the best. After all, being one of the crowd was probably the easiest way to cover her tracks until she could, she desperately hoped, get out of the building and make her way home. And after that? Well, she had no idea what to do after that. Stricken with fear as she was, she couldn't help noticing how different the crowd's behaviour was to when they'd carried out their practice drills. Those had been quiet, orderly affairs, with people heading calmly for the exits. As soon as the alarms had unexpectedly gone off and the loudspeakers had said, "This is not a drill," everything had changed. Now she was in a frightened, jostling mob, some of them swearing, most of them yelling, demanding the people ahead of them move faster, asking what the hell was happening, calling for friends. The one advantage, Evie thought, was that in a crowd of panicking people no one would notice how terrified she was herself. Keep going, then. Flow along in the river of people, like everyone else, and hope to wash up safe in the street outside. One man who was fighting against the direction of the crowd was Roger Dascombe, making his way toward the news studio that was his normally untouchable pride and joy. A small group were already gathered by the door, mostly his personal team of security men, and it took only a moment for Dascombe to shoulder his way through them. "What the bloody hell is going on here?" he shouted furiously, barely able to make himself heard above the alarm bells. "It's jammed," one of the security men told him flatly. As if it were so bloody obvious they couldn't get in, it hardly needed saying. If they could have done, the bullets would have been flying long ago.
"Then break it down!"
screamed Dascombe, a note of hysteria creeping into his voice. This shouldn't be happening. Not in his precious studio, not in his perfectly regulated private domain, not to him.
"And turn those fucking alarm bells off!"
he shouted raggedly, to no one in particular, just about reaching the end of his tether now. Back in the corridor, Evie had nearly reached the stairwell door when the crowd streaming toward it was suddenly sent staggering aside as Finch and his police came bursting through. For a moment, she thought they were just here in response to the alarm, or perhaps to whatever mischief V was cooking up now, though mischief probably wasn't a strong enough word for whatever it was V had planned. Chaos was much more like it, or even complete anarchy. Only Evie suddenly realized she was the one who was in trouble. Finch looked directly toward her, then suddenly pointed at her as well and yelled, "Dominic!" at the top of his voice, and a younger, lither, far more energetic man suddenly began to push his way through the crowd in her direction.
"Oh my God!"
she thought, suddenly completely panic-stricken and twisting round to push her way back through the mob.
"They found me! They know!"
"Police!"
Finch was shouting furiously now, following along in Dominic's wake, fighting his way through the ever more agitated mob in the corridor.
"Get out of the bloody way!"
Sick with terror, pushing, shoving, and clawing at a hand that tried to restrain her, Evie fought her way back to a corner and managed to slip round it, out of sight of her pursuers. Only a moment later, Finch and Dominic rounded the same corner, but that was a moment too late. The quarry had completely disappeared.
"Damn it!"
grated Finch, and stood a moment regaining his breath. Both of them knew what they had to do next, and a few seconds later they started hurriedly opening office doors and continuing the search. In the news studio, V had now reached the control booth, and, detonator still brandished, pressed a DCD into the sweaty palm of a young technician. The grinning mask said nothing, hinted nothing, but somehow the young man knew exactly what was wanted. A sick expression passed across his face, almost as if the intruder had asked him to shoot himself. But then, as he did seem to be confronted by a mad bomber, that might have been the easy option. Desperate for someone else to take the responsibility off his shoulders, the technician turned toward a group of suited executives who cowered in the corner, at least one of whom looked to be on the verge of a heart attack. No help from him, then. But one of the others nodded slowly, and with an almost audible sigh of relief, the younger man slipped the disc into the player. If old Jenkins had told him to go ahead, at least he wasn't likely to get tagged as being the terrorist's collaborator. Assuming there was anything left of him to tag, when this was all over. Or of any of them. Dominic, meanwhile, came barging through the door of the JPA's room, the corridor still alive with motion behind him, to find himself in empty stillness. The only sound was the laugh track of a sitcom coming from a monitor screen on one wall. For a moment he felt as if the set were laughing at him and the futility of his search. And perhaps it was. For as soon as he slammed the door behind him and left, Evie emerged from her hiding place beneath a desk, shoving aside the boxes of files she'd drawn in around her for cover. Then suddenly the laugh track stopped dead, swallowed up in a buzz of static. And when Evie looked up toward the screen, the image had disappeared as well. All across London, television screens large and small went blank in just the same way, from the tiniest portables to the most gigantic jumbotrons suspended high above the crowds in Piccadilly Circus. From retirement homes, where old men fiddled grumpily with their TV antennae, through pubs and clubs where a blank screen meant an opportunity to get another pint before the picture came back or the lunch was served, to family homes where small boys asked plaintively, "Mum, what's gone wrong with the telly?" Everything was silence and signal-less snowy screens, and puzzled anticipation. But not for long. In the JPA's room, Evie was getting to her feet and preparing to make another break for freedom when the monitor suddenly winked into life once more. And there was V's familiar mask, grinning down at her, his face almost filling the screen as if in a parody of Sutler's overbearing political broadcasts. In one corner of the screen appeared not the usual BTN logo, but VTV instead, and in a calm, almost professional announcer's voice, he began. "Good morning, London." And Evie could only shrink away. This was getting too much for anyone's nerves, let alone hers, after the previous night's events. Fear was starting to make her feel nauseous by now. Roger Dascombe wasn't taking things well either. Even though the alarm bells had been turned off now, he was getting more and more wound up by the failure of his security men to get through the door. Then, to his horror, he noticed the on-air light was glowing, and V's voice was echoing everywhere throughout the building. "Allow me, first, to apologize for this interruption."
"That's the emergency channel!"
screamed Dascombe, knowing full well it'd be overriding every broadcast in the land, and with that he bolted away to find a set on which to watch, leaving his minions to sort out the problem with the door. "I do," V's voice continued, "like many of you, appreciate the comforts of the everyday routine, the security of the familiar, the tranquillity of television. I enjoy them as much as anyone."
"Bloody hell,"
said Finch, looking up at the screen in the wardrobe department where he had been searching for Evie. Well, that'd have to be left to the ordinary coppers now, he thought, heading back toward the door. Right now he needed to get along to the studio and get this sorted out. Or more to the point, get this stopped. At the same time, a part of him didn't want to leave the screen, which told him that even if he did get it stopped, the terrorist would almost certainly have escaped by then. After all, this was a man who was obviously too smart to commit real or potential suicide for the sake of a single broadcast, and that he might be better using his time to watch his enemy and perhaps learn something of the way he'd think and act. One thing was certain. He knew enough about television to exploit the medium for his own purposes. On screens across the land, the camera pulled back away from the close-up of V's mask, to show him sitting at a desk, hatless now but still masked and wigged, while behind his shoulder the BTN logo that usually appeared with the normal newsreaders had been sprayed over with a circle containing the letter V. He began to speak again. "But in the spirit of commemoration, whereby those important events of the past, usually associated with someone's death, or with the end of some awful, bloody struggle, are celebrated with a nice holiday, I thought that this year we could mark the 5th of November, a day that sadly is no longer remembered, by taking some time out of our daily lives to sit down and have a little chat." By now, Dascombe had withdrawn to his private office, with Patricia and several armed guards, and was pacing up and down in front of the TV set, looking almost ready to start tearing out his perfectly groomed hair by the roots.
"Let me think,"
he said to no one in particular, as if it were a mantra that, said aloud, would somehow help him do so.
"Let me think!"
And all those around him stood in silence, and let him get on with it. Except that V's continuing voice wouldn't let him think at all. "There are those, of course, who do not want us to speak. In fact, I suspect that right now orders are being shouted into phones, and that men with guns will soon be on their way." As if on cue, a cell phone rang on Dascombe's desk. Patricia picked it up, listened for a few seconds, then thrust it out toward him.
"It's Chancellor Suttler,"
she said nervously, looking almost as if the phone were too hot to handle, or likely at any moment to turn into a venomous snake.
"God damn it!"
grated Dascombe and snatched it from her hand.
"Anything and everything will be done to stop me talking to you," V was saying, this time on the monitor in the security station that had previously been showing Storm Saxon, where Finch had paused and now stood watching as Dominic ran up to join him.
"We're going to need a torch,"
Dominic told him, obviously referring to the problem with the studio door. But Finch merely nodded, leaving his lieutenant to sort it out, having decided by now that he was far more interested in the voice of the man he'd already come to regard as a personal opponent. And when the face was not to be seen, every nuance of the voice needed to be absorbed, of the body language, of the thought behind the words. Know your enemy. Just as relevant now as it ever was.
"Why?" asked V. "Because while the truncheon may be used in lieu of conversation, words will always retain their power."
Still not leaving the JPA's room, Evie stood transfixed, looking at the screen and feeling almost as if V were talking directly to her. That same magnetic voice that she'd heard last night continued to hold her in its thrall.
Words offer the means to meaning, and for those who will listen, the enunciation of truth. The truth is, there is something terribly wrong with this country, isn't there?
In his office, a sweating Roger Dascombe was trying to listen to Sutler with one ear and V with the other, though obviously only one of them needed a reply.
"You designed it, sir,"
he pointed out, trying to sugar the pill of truth with as much of a tone of obsequiousness as seemed appropriate, and to shift the blame as much as possible.
"You wanted it foolproof. You told me every television in London—"
But then V's voice cut across his train of thought, becoming more powerful now, more strident.
"Cruelty and injustice, intolerance and oppression, and where once you had the freedom to object, to think and speak as you saw fit, you now have censors and systems of surveillance coercing your conformity and soliciting your submission."
Roger Dascombe, forgetting for an instant whom he was talking to, looked round toward the open door of his office, and saw several policemen hauling a large acetylene torch along the corridor toward the still unyielding studio door.
"Cameras!" he screamed suddenly. "We need cameras!"
And facing another camera, V opened out his gloved hands expressively to match the questions in his words.
"How did this happen? Who is to blame? Certainly there are those who are more responsible than others, and they will be held accountable. But again, if truth be told, if you are looking for the guilty, you need only look in the mirror."
V paused then, and all across the city viewers did the same as the words sank in varying degrees, of course.
"I know why you did it," he continued. "I know you were afraid. Who wouldn't be? War, terror, disease, food and water shortages. There were a myriad problems which conspired to corrupt your reason and rob you of your common sense."
Somehow, then, even the mask couldn't hide V's obvious sense of disappointment.
"Fear got the best of you, and in your panic you turned to the now High Chancellor, Adam Sutler, with his gleaming boots of polished leather and his garrison of goons. He promised you order, he promised you peace, and all he demanded in return was your silent, obedient consent."
Another pause from the masked man of a myriad screens, during which Dominic returned to the security station to update Finch.
"Inspector, they're almost through," he said,
and Finch nodded uncertainly before turning his back on the screen and following him down the corridor. He arrived just as Dascombe did, accompanied by a small video crew.
"Last night," V said, picking up the thread, "I sought to end the silence. Last night, I destroyed the Old Bailey, to remind this country of what it had forgotten. 400 years ago, one of our citizens wished to embed the 5th of November forever in our memory. His hope was to remind the world that fairness, justice, and freedom were more than words. They are perspectives. So, if you have seen nothing—"
And here the voice sank in an obvious expression of distaste for anyone so obviously blind.
"If the crimes of this government remain unknown to you, then I suggest that you allow the 5th of November to pass unmarked. But if you see what I see—"
And now the magnetism was back, as V started into his rousing finale.
"If you feel as I feel, if you would seek as I seek freedom from their tyranny and an end to this oppression, then I ask you to stand beside me, 1 year from last night, outside the gates of Parliament, and together we shall give them a 5th of November that shall never, ever be forgot."
With that, the recording ended, and V's masked face was lost in static. And those of his audience, mesmerized by what he had to say, and there were not a few of them spread across the city and the country, suddenly found they had the power to move restored to them. and among the first to move was Evie Hammond, who, snapping out of her trance and looking round thankfully to find herself still alone, bolted from the room. 5. With a spray of melting metal, a hissing roar of flame, and more smoke than anyone might reasonably have expected, the acetylene torch finally sliced through the last section of the heavy, soundproofed studio door, and a hefty police boot immediately kicked it in. It hit the floor flat, with a loud thud, but before another boot could be laid on top of it, a thick cloud of fog belched out into the hall, engulfing police, security guards, and studio staff alike. Finch, newly arrived on the scene, tried to peer through the dense grey blanket, but could see absolutely nothing, all the lights having been extinguished as well. In the sudden quiet following the end of V's broadcast, the hum of a small motor broke the almost eerie silence of the dim, beclouded studio.
"Kerosene fog," Dascombe remarked, appearing at Finch's shoulder. "He's using our smoke machine."
Not particularly grateful for information he could have figured out himself, Finch turned to Dominic and softly instructed him to cover the exits. Was that to have the best man on that particular job, or to save him from whatever might be waiting in the studio? Finch found he couldn't really say. As the younger man left, going about his task with quiet efficiency, Finch turned to his gathered band of coppers, wondering just how many of them would get out of this alive. Or, looking at the barely disguised thuggery that gleamed in many a slightly glassy eye, hopped up as they were on the prospect of violence, how many of them deserved to get out alive. The police service wasn't anything like it used to be in his younger days, and these were just the wimps who couldn't make it into the finger. Still, right now there was a far more important question in his mind. Would he get out alive? "You two stay here," he told a disappointed pair, though they did look a little more encouraged when he told them, "No one gets out." "The rest of you," he added, beckoning the others forward, "follow me." And Dascombe and his camera crew tagged along behind as well. No one was going to keep him out of his own studio, especially when that studio was at the centre of the news. The fog still billowing around them, they began to pick their way cautiously into the cavernous studio, edging past the shadowy forms of camera dollies and long-extinguished lighting gear, of directors' chairs and the telescopic arms of drooping microphone booms. A familiar, cool chill ran down Finch's spine, while a cold sweat made the palm of his gun hand greasy, though the last thing he was going to do right now was change hands to wipe it. He was jumpy as hell, and if that was how he felt, nearly 40 years a copper, he could only conjecture how the young thugs behind him were feeling in their turn. He just hoped that the one with the itchy trigger finger wouldn't turn out to be standing directly behind him. Ahead, in the grey blankness, there was the sound of movement, a vague thrashing noise. Guns and cameras zeroed in, each in its way, ready to shoot. Next came the sound of footsteps, stumbling at first, then running toward them. A shout in the fog.
"Don't shoot! Please don't shoot!"
And a dark figure emerged from the blanketing greyness, cloak flapping around its shoulders, a grinning white mask upon its face. Behind Finch, before he could even think, and certainly before they had, the police gunmen opened fire, and the inspector threw himself flat and prayed. Twisting in the air like an unstrung doll, the caped figure flipped and went down, twitching and jerking in a cacophonous hail of bullets, and lay still, quite still. Hoping no one would shoot it off, Finch raised a hand, barking an order as he started to get to his feet, and the guns fell silent. Then, with extreme caution, he stepped forward. Leaking blood, the man lay strangely twisted on his side. The shooting having stopped, he began to writhe in pain, yet somehow seemed unable to get his hands to any of his wounds. Only then did Finch notice his wrists were zip-tied behind his back. With a horrible sinking feeling in his gut, the inspector reached out and pulled the mask away from the man's face. An old man's face, white with terror and with pain.
"That's no terrorist!" exclaimed Dascombe,
appearing suddenly at Finch's shoulder, camera crew close in turn.
"That's Brownlee's, one of our studio executives."
He put masks on all of us,"
the man managed to gasp out weakly, then lapsed into silence, his eyes closing, his teeth gritted in a rictus of pain.
"Jesus!"
yelled Finch, appalled. More shuffling and stumbling noises emerged from the slowly clearing fog, and another shout.
"Don't shoot! Dear God, don't shoot!"
a theme picked up, with multiple variants by a multitude of voices. And then the men themselves appeared ahead of Finch, all caped, all masked, all tripping over their own feet in terror. And behind him the police began to mutter and stamp their feet, their growing sense of uncomprehending panic almost palpable. It would take only one nervous trigger finger, one shot, and all hell would break loose. A police massacre, not as uncommon as they used to be, but still something they could do without right now.
"Freeze!"
shouted Finch, as loudly and commandingly as he possibly could, an order directed at those both before and behind.
"Nobody move!"
The shadows in the mist came to a ragged halt, stumbling awkwardly, one of them falling helplessly to the ground.
"If you're wearing a mask, get down on your knees,"
Finch ordered next.
"Now!"
The caped forms crumpled to the floor, and behind Finch one of the police hissed through his teeth softly, releasing his own tension and, somehow, doing the same for the rest of them.
"Get their masks off," Finch said more calmly, pointedly saying nothing about releasing their hands,
and, accompanied by his men, he began to slowly and cautiously move forward.
"Please hurry,"
said the kneeling man Finch approached first. A different voice, this lacking the elderly tone of the others. The voice of the same young technician who'd been forced to play the intruder's recording, a voice that next pronounced a doom-laden message of terror.
"He's got a bomb wired to a timer in the control booth!"
"Oh, no!"
groaned Dascombe, still standing forgotten behind Finch, and suddenly white-faced. People getting shot was one thing, news, but his beloved studio.
"Bloody Christ!"
muttered Finch, as Dascombe bolted for the booth, camera crew still tagging along behind.
"Jones! Get anyone not wearing a mask out of here!"
Then, glancing back at the wounded, possibly dying executive who'd been cut down in the first volley,
"Marshal, help carry this man."
With a horrible sinking feeling in his belly, he started after Dascombe, beckoning the rest of his men to keep searching the studio for the real terrorist.
"Everyone else, let's go."
His every move being taped by the pursuing crew, Dascombe had reached the smoke-filled control booth and paused in horror.
"Good God!"
he breathed, his knees suddenly threatening to give way beneath him as he looked through the fog at the red LED lights of a clock, already passing 4 minutes and rushing inexorably back toward 3. From an open panel in the side of the clock, wires snaked away to the vest of dynamite sticks that V had earlier been wearing. And somewhere in Dascombe's head, a voice was whispering that it wasn't electricity running along those wires. It was evil. Evil on a cosmic scale that threatened to overthrow whole worlds of order. Most particularly, his. And destiny had picked him out, like a knight in shining armour, to do battle on behalf of the forces of light and save the world from darkness. Or, at least, to make sure it still had the 9 o'clock news. By the time Finch arrived in the booth, shouldering aside the camera crew, they protested, of course. This was great television, and what could be more important than that? Dascombe was down on his knees before the bomb, almost as if in prayer. But it wasn't a rosary or a prayer book he had clutched in his hands. It was a pair of wire cutters.
"Dascombe!"
yelled Finch sharply. But before he could say anything else, Dascombe had turned to face him, and something about his face now stopped the words on his lips. For Roger Dascombe was a man transfigured, a man who, forced to the greatest decision he'd ever had to make, had almost reached a state of grace. Which was the most important, his life or the studio? But somehow he'd transcended the opposites. Quite plainly, his life was the studio. There was no question to answer. Anything else to be decided could be rendered up to God, and the almost sanctified pair of wire cutters he held in his hand. "Do you have any idea how long it would take to rebuild this facility?" Dascombe asked, with a near supernal calm and a strange luminescence in his eyes.
"Do you have any idea what you're doing?"
Finch grated harshly, hoping that some word would shake Dascombe out of this state that, to an honest copper like him, looked close to madness.
"Pray that I do," Dascombe smiled, turning back to the device.
And Finch, knowing that any race to get a disposal unit here in time would be won hands down by the bomb, began to pray very earnestly indeed. Outside the studio, Jones had managed to shepherd the unmasked studio executives past the two policemen left guarding the torch-down door, and so, he hoped, to safety. He was about to go back in and get himself a piece of whatever action was left, when he heard another shout from the still-befogged studio.
"Wait!" came the cry. "Don't shoot! Wait for us!"
Two more masked men, like all the others wearing capes, came rushing through the door. Jones jumped back, uncertain which of the two to train his gun upon, hoping desperately that the other two guards would cover the one he didn't.
"Damn it!" he thought. "This wasn't a situation for poor bloody infantry like them to sort out."
But no superior officer was in sight. Seeming to shove each other aside in their haste to escape, the two masked men lurched into the hall, the first suddenly pushed, somehow, by the second, and desperately trying to retain his footing, barging into the three cops and scattering them. By the time they'd regained their wits, the second man had stumbled awkwardly, his hands still fixed behind his back, and gone sprawling on the floor. And then he began to yell. Yell words that, just then, were the last things that Jones wanted to hear.
"Shoot!"
he shrieked, looking up toward his standing companion.
"Dear God, it's him! Shoot!"
The upright man hurriedly spun round, though strangely did nothing more than that, to face the three policemen who had by now regained their composure sufficiently to ensure that all three pistols were pointing dead straight in his direction. But that was about as far as their composure went. The wonder was that none of those three pistols had yet gone off.
"On your knees!"
screamed Jones, the note of rising panic obvious in his voice.
"Get down on your knees!"
And, to his enormous relief, the man actually did. Slowly, awkwardly, silently. No one moved. Someone had to. Blowing out a breath, and then sucking in an even larger one, Jones raised his free hand, gesturing for the other two to stay back and cover him. Then, holding his gun before him, almost as if it were a crucifix with which to fend off a vampire, he took a slow pace forward. Another, yet more slow, then tentatively, nervously, reached out to pull off the man's mask. And, ripping it away, revealed Fred Thorpe, the security guard, his eyes stretched wide with terror, his mouth stuffed full of gag. And before any of them had time to react, V had risen from the floor as swiftly as a striking cobra, all pretense now thrown aside, the real V, his hands not bound in any way behind him, but rather holding long knives. So sharp, those blades, and such a silvery glint along their edges it was almost beautiful to see, until they suddenly crimsoned for a moment, and after that were never seen again. It was over in an instant. Jones never got off a shot, being closest as he was, though his companions did, but all their bullets found was a billowing cloak swirled out around their target, confusing their aim like a bullfighter's cape, no red rag this, but simply formless shadow. And then there was no time for further shooting. There was only time for screaming, and the noise of cracking bone, and the wicked, slicing sound of sharp knives sinking into human meat, and falling bodies, and sightless eyes, and slowly spreading pools of thick, coagulating gore. Poor, bloody infantry. It was only sweat that was pouring from Finch's brow back in the studio control booth, as he watched Roger Dascom, still somehow bathed in that glow of serenity that Finch himself was desperately wishing for, almost certainly about to bring their lives to a shattered, shredded end. And if he didn't, the clock, now rapidly nearing zero, quite definitely would. The clock and the bomb attached. How did it feel to be blown to bits? Finch didn't really know, but was rather afraid he'd soon find out. And it wasn't much comfort to think he wouldn't be alone in the discovery, or that it would almost certainly be quick. 2 or 3 minutes had passed while Finch had assumed that Dascom was examining the bomb. But then he realized he was doing nothing of the sort. He was simply using the last moments of his life for some sort of demented contemplation, until there was no time left for anything else but decisive action. And now that time had finally arrived.
"Here we go," said Dascom coolly, and clipped a wire.
A tiny noise, but in the frozen silence of the room more than enough to make Finch jump. He blew out a nervous breath and raised a thankful glance toward heaven, then realized that no one else had made a move or said a word. Looking back toward Dascom, he saw the man still down there on his knees, his eyes still fixed religiously on the clock. The clock that still continued to tick down the last few seconds with a horrid, glacial slowness. 4, 3, 2, 1, 0. Nothing. No explosion, no screams, no noise, no pain. No death. And then the tension broke, restoring Roger Dascom to almost human form.
"I did it!"
he exclaimed, face alight with quite another excitement now.
"I did it!"
"Damn," muttered Finch, there seeming nothing else to say. And leaving Dascom to his triumph, he turned away and began to push his way through the crowd at the door, some laughing, some looking nauseous, some just slumping to the ground, depending on how the stress and its relieving took them. He was sure he'd never like Dascom, but he had to admit that when it came to the things he sincerely thought were important, the man certainly had balls. Not much sense, perhaps, but balls. And because of Dascom's demented foolhardiness, they'd managed to put a stop to one of their foes' relentless attacks.
"And now I've got to catch him,"
he added, to no one in particular. Not far away, Evie Hammond was hurrying along the corridor toward the elevators, hoping desperately that now the fire alarms had been switched off, they would have been restored to full function as well. But not far from Fred Thorpe's still vacant security station, she suddenly glanced up. And there, coming from the direction of the studio in silent haste, was V. All her guts knotting up at the sight of him, Evie ducked into a doorway and simply hid. Ridiculous as those old stories were about ostriches hiding their heads in the sand, now she could see the logic behind them after all. If it wasn't the police, it was V, and she just wanted all of them to go away. Wanted to get home and hide her head under the bed covers, then to wake up tomorrow morning and find that everything was once again the way it had been yesterday. And for today and last night to have simply never happened. Yes, there was something enormously attractive about V, despite that she had no idea of his looks. A sense of wildness and freedom, and the potential to be so much more than any normal person ever would, but at the same time that wildness and that freedom were terrifying. And the violence only made it worse, especially to one who feared the world as much as she did. So hide, then. Wait until he'd gone, and then try to slip away before he or anyone else noticed. But to know when he'd gone required risking a glance round the corner before she dared to make a move. No, not yet. She'd guessed the timing wrong, and he had only just arrived at the elevators, reaching out to press the button and summon up a car. But when his finger was a mere inch away...
"Freeze!"
Dominic Stone's voice rang out first, and then the young policeman himself appeared, emerging from his hiding place behind the security desk. His gun was firmly held in a two-handed grip, and it was pointing with absolutely unerring aim directly between the masked man's eyes. And there was something in his handsome bravery that she had to admire,
or would have done anyway under any other circumstances. Right now, though, he was the last person she wanted to see.
"Get your hands on your head!"
he shouted harshly, tension edging a voice he was, with some small success, struggling to control.
"Do it now, or I shoot!"
As if her previous terror weren't enough, by now Evie was thrown into a complete panic. A few seconds ago the course of action had seemed obvious. Just wait a little longer for the situation to clear, then escape. But what on earth was she going to do now? If V was arrested, and the rest of the police came back here to this landing, she'd never get an elevator. Probably never reach the stairwell either. Whether they got V or not, they'd still be after her as well. And besides, if V was arrested now, things would never change. No wildness, no freedom, no potential. Just eternal Adam Sutler, and Fingerman, and terror. And which of those alternatives was actually the more terrifying? "I must say," V declared, a few paces away and with his hands now firmly placed behind his head, "that I'm rather astonished by the response time of London's finest. I hadn't expected you to be so Johnny on the spot."
"We were here before you even got started," Dominic told him,
eyes and aim never wavering from the target, concentration never lapsing for an instant. No point in telling him they'd come here looking for someone else entirely, and that him being here had just been a fortunate coincidence.
"Bad luck, chummy."
"Oh, I don't know about that," V told him calmly, not moving a muscle, but looking past the young policeman and farther down the corridor. Still, the gun didn't waver, nor the concentration. Even so, Dominic couldn't prevent the images that were rising up unbidden in his mind. The man who caught the terrorist. His picture in the papers, the television interviews, celebrity, promotion. Maybe even the police medal, though that didn't mean as much these days as it used to. When the hand tapped him lightly, almost tentatively, on the shoulder, Dominic jumped so much it was a miracle his jerking finger didn't pull the trigger. But that much he did manage to achieve. Looking round, though, was something he couldn't prevent. And there was Evie, right behind him, and looking absolutely terrified at what she was doing, the pepper spray held up and little more than 6 inches from his face, right before his widening eyes. And then she pressed the button. Screaming, blinded, retching in pain and shock, he reached out instinctively and managed to grab her wrist, twisting the spray away before she could do any more damage, making her yelp with the bone-crushing tightness of his grip. And then he was spinning toward her, attacking sightlessly, swinging the pistol like a club. Cold metal cracked against Evie's temple, and her legs buckled, sending her collapsing to the floor just as V moved forward and dragged Dominic away from her. No time for steel now, just instant, unarmed retribution. A straight-fingered knife hand jabbed viciously into the policeman's solar plexus, taking his wind and doubling him over in exactly the right position for a hammer-like elbow straight down on the base of his skull. Dominic was unconscious before his head hit the floor. And then, for the first time in a long, long while, V stood there over the prone pair of bodies, staring down at Evie, and quite uncertain what to do next. Not long afterward, television screens across the land blinked into life once more, reappearing with a somber and obviously hurriedly constructed caption, "Special Emergency Report." And in those same retirement homes, pubs and clubs, and middle-class family homes that only a short while ago had hosted V's interruption to the schedule for an audience both puzzled and enthralled, expectant viewers held their breath and wondered what they'd be getting next. What they got was Dick, this time without June, without the viewer-friendly sofa, and definitely without the reassuring "All's Well with the World" smile, but with a banner logo in the corner of the screen saying, "Crisis at Jordan Tower." "We are interrupting your regularly scheduled program," he began, as if the program hadn't already been interrupted, "to bring you this terrifying report of a terrorist takeover of Jordan Tower, which ended only moments ago." All this was said with a grim and dour expression to match his tone of voice. then a pause, just to make sure everyone had got the point. The takeover had ended. There was no longer any crisis. Normal order was rapidly being restored. Professional as ever, and with a script written almost instantly by Roger Dascombe himself, who now believed that there was nothing beyond his power to do. A psychotic male terrorist, identified only by the code letter V, attacked the studios and control booth with high-powered explosives and other weapons, used against innocent, unarmed civilians in order to broadcast a message of hate. We have just received this footage of a daring police raid. At this point, the screen began to display an edited extract from the handheld, grainy video footage that Dascombe's crew had shot on entering the studio behind the police. Cinema verite, it looked, with its swirling fog and cacophonous volley of gunfire, its twisting, bleeding body and its screams. And cinema verite it was, except that the cry of "Don't shoot" had been edited out. And no one mentioned how many men in masks had been found in the studio, or that this one, now on life support in a nearby hospital but fading fast, was not, in fact, the right one. No one would know about that, of course. The main thing was to show the audience the gunshots and the blood and the obvious evidence that the terrorist was dead. Threat over. See how efficient the police and security services were. Feel safe. More to the point, heed the warning, don't try it, Buster. You too could end up like dead meat in the butcher's shop, the same as the masked poltroon who'd been talking all that crap a few minutes before, and getting shot dead like that, he was lucky. "This is only an initial report," Dick's voiceover continued, until the camera returned to him and his now much more reassuring smile. "But at this time it is believed that during this heroic raid the terrorist was shot and killed." And then, with just a hint of triumph and much more emphasis, as if the louder it was said, the much more obviously it would be true, "again, from what we have been told by the authorities, the danger is now over, and the terrorist is dead." And somewhere on a hill in southeast London, a little girl who could have been Evie a dozen years before, and whose parents were already suspected of being dangerously free thinkers, said precisely what she thought, and what her parents thought, and half the population of the city, too. Bollocks! 6. Evie woke in darkness, a dull, throbbing pain in the side of her head that felt as if someone were thumping it insistently and sadistically with a rubber mallet, only to realize a little later that the throbbing was actually caused by the pumping of arterial blood through the bruised and sensitive skin where she'd been hit by the policeman's automatic. She'd always known there was a pulse there, but this was more like the crack of doom, a doom that just kept repeating itself over and over forever and ever. Reaching up to touch it, she found a cool, damp compress over the welt and wondered who on earth could have put it there. With that memory of how she'd been rendered unconscious, and all that had happened before it, came first horror, and then the realization that she was lying in a bed, still fully dressed. But not her own bed. Not in her own apartment. A weak ray of light was leaking into the windowless room from a door that stood slightly ajar. A warm, candle-like glow that spilled across the bed. And as her eyes adjusted, allowed her to take in just a little of her surroundings. The room seemed to have no walls, or rather, every inch of wall was hidden by bookshelves, all of them stacked horizontally so that even more volumes could be crammed into the available space, book upon book, rising up with the density of bricks so that it almost seemed that they and nothing else were supporting the low and vaulted ceiling that loomed above the bed like a stone canopy. More books than she'd ever seen, outside of a library. And quite apart from the shelves, there were more stacks of books rising from the floor, occasionally falling back to spill in untidied chaos, like breaking waves in a vast sea of literature. And near at hand, that soft light from the door picked out a few gold-decorated spines and gave their authors' names a hallowed glow. Oscar Wilde, Radcliffe Hall, William Beckford, banned authors every one, or so she had to think. Some of the names, such as Pierre Louis, she'd never even heard of before. Beside the light there came soft music from beyond the door. For a moment she wasn't sure what it was, but then she remembered it from long, long ago. The sort of music she'd last heard when she was just a little girl, the kind her father liked. Blues. Black American music. Banned, like the books around her. And then she almost choked on a memory, rising up out of the past and threatening to strangle her with its sweet, cloying loveliness, of lying in bed on a Sunday morning with Teddy in her arms, warm and safe, and 5 years old, entranced by the dust motes floating in a beam of golden sunshine, recovering from a childhood illness, and smelling Mummy's roast beef and Yorkshire pudding, and Daddy's pipe smoke rising from the downstairs living room as that same song was played on an ancient hi-fi. And how Daddy always mowed the lawn on Sunday mornings, and how there was wisteria growing against the garden wall, and there was always, always sunshine. And then she knew she was going to have to get up and find out what this was all about, before she burst into salty, melancholic tears. Beyond the door was a short passage that somehow reminded her of a wine cellar, leading to a larger room, more startling and more wonderful even than the bedroom book room in which she'd awoken, but windowless just the same. Like some sort of storeroom from a museum or art gallery, or both combined, the place was packed with artworks from the Renaissance to the modern, from art for art's sake to the commercial, from Titian to the comic book cover. Comic books themselves as well, abused as they were, though mostly of the underground, political or artistic varieties that never quite received the treatment they deserved. Still more books, too, with fictions from the Iliad to Raymond Chandler, philosophies from Plato to Foucault, works of the now-eradicated neo-pagan religions, and histories by the hundreds containing tales that it seemed no one ever paid any attention to anymore. More than this, there was all that could be saved of the popular culture, swept away by Suttler's fascist imperialism. The DVDs and videos, CDs, cassettes, and even old vinyl albums, blues, soul, Tamla Motown, gypsy music, protest songs, an endless cornucopia now tossed away like a fistful of dead roses. Again, there were movie posters, papering the wall behind all these foreground piles. Humphrey Bogart, George Raft, James Cagney. Old gangsters never die. But it seemed they'd been asleep for longer than she could remember. And in a corner, gleaming brashly with its chrome and plastic and electric lights, a 1950s jukebox, from which that same old blues came gently crooning forth. And Evie could only stand there like Alice in Wonderland, choking up with mingled melancholy nostalgia and equal portions of delight. So many things she thought were lost, so many things preserved. From out of the shadows, V silently emerged, capeless now, but still masked and wigged, still dressed in the same Jacobean tunic, breeches and boots.
"Oh!" yelped Evie, startled. "You scared me."
"My apologies," he said gently, a genuine concern quite obvious in his voice. "Are you feeling all right?"
"Yes, thank you,"
she told him warily. A little reassured by his tone, but still uncertain about so many things, including his intentions.
"What is this place?"
"My home," he replied. And artificial as it obviously was, there seemed to be something genuine about the smile upon the mask. Or perhaps the smile was in his voice. "I call it the Shadow Gallery."
"It's beautiful."
Evie turned to let her eye run over the assembled treasures once again, always spotting new things she hadn't seen before. Was that really an Egyptian mummy case over there in the shadows? Or just some movie backlot prop? And those strange wooden carvings, like the ones she used to see in the Africa shop before Suttler's thugs had burned the place down. Japanese woodblock prints. Buddhas. It just seemed endless.
"Where did you get all this stuff?"
"Here and there. he said lightly as the blues tune came to an end, idly starting to wander round the room and taking in the display with a single all-encompassing wave of the hand. Much of it comes from the vaults of the Ministry of Objectionable Materials.
"You stole them?"
Evie asked, wide-eyed, suddenly afraid once more.
"Was there nothing this man wouldn't dare? Theft, violence, terrorism? And here she was with him, in his headquarters, consorting with an enemy of the state. What would they do to her if ever anyone found out?"
"Heavens, no!" A gentle laugh added unexpected warmth to his voice. "Stealing implies ownership. You cannot steal from a censor. I merely reclaimed them."
"God, if they ever find this place,"
Evie began, but didn't quite complete the thought. "I suspect that if they do find this place," V told her, making light of the thought, "a few bits of art will be the least of my worries."
"You mean, after what you've done?"
replied Evie. And then all the events of the previous day came flooding back, and the floor seemed to tilt beneath her feet.
"Oh, God!"
Suddenly all the wonderland around her didn't look anywhere near so wonderful at all, and her head, forgotten for a while in overwhelming novelty, began to throb once more.
"What have I done?"
she asked, mainly to herself, a hand raised to massage her forehead, as if that would somehow make her brain work the better.
"I'm maced a detective!"
A groan of despair.
"Oh, no! Why did I do that?"
"You did what you thought was right," V told her, in an almost fatherly, reassuring tone.
"No," said Evie, shaking her head in rejection. "I shouldn't have done it. I must have been out of my mind."
"Is that what you really think?" he asked, and now somehow he reminded her of one of her old schoolteachers. "Or is that what they would want you to think?" This book is continued on Disc 3.